Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Catch and Shoot 2.0 is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. Catch and Shoot 2.0 goes well with both red and white and is perfect with the workout of your choice. Our hosts are Aaron Berlin, a former Kansas Jayhawk who believes the Orlando Magic will win the championship. Eventually. His partner is Otto Strong, a man who has covered the NBA since before Dennis Rodman got his first tattoo. Fellas?
Well, after 5 weeks and 10 episodes, The Last Dance documentary produced by ESPN is officially over. The one that not only covered Michael Jordan, but also those tremendous Bulls teams in the 90s. We're breaking it down, what we thought of the last two episodes, as well as maybe some things that we liked, didn't like in the episodes. And then we're going to also give you some teams that we would like to see have documentaries made in Last Dance style. But before we do all that, I have to welcome in my co-host and all this. He is operating out of Strong Strategies today. His name is Otto Strong. Otto, how's it going?
What's going on, man? How you been?
Oh, well, you know, I've been in about Zoom calls all day long. So getting to see you and talk to you in, you know, for basketball is tremendous for me. But just kind of digesting the last two episodes of The Last Dance was a lot of fun. Anything going on in your world?
Oh, just a lot of work on Fort Worth Star-Telegram stories.
Do you feel like in a work-from-home environment, like you spend more time working than you did before? Because that's kind of how I feel. You know, like going into the office didn't feel like work. When I have to sit down at home and do work, that feels like work.
It's definitely more of a challenge, no doubt. And you know, like we've discussed on previous shows, a lot of what we were doing while, you know, at the time when there were no sports was working on education stories and public interest stories. And so now the pendulum is kind of swinging back into sports a little bit. We've had some NASCAR. We've got some horse racing coming up. We've got a golf tournament going on in a couple of weeks.
Maybe obviously, getting some basketball back, right?
Maybe getting some basketball, maybe. Rumors of baseball, NFL draft, all kinds of stuff happening. So things are starting to creep back into the reality of lots of sports. And a reminder as to why we love all this stuff.
Absolutely. And it's crazy how it all just, you know, kind of worked with that 5 week window with ESPN deciding to move up the date of these documentaries with kind of just the calendar starting to flip back. And maybe we're starting to get some sense of normalcy, but we did get the final two episodes, episodes 9 and 10, not only covering that tremendous series also with the Pacers, but you know, two finals opposite of the Utah Jazz. There are some things that I thought were a little quirky with it, but before we get into what I thought about it, what did you think of episodes 9 and 10?
Well, episodes 9 and 10, relative to the other episodes, you know, there was very little, obviously, by that point that was being new, very little bit that was introduced. I did like the way they touched upon Steve Kerr and dealt with his particular story. And I thought that was effective, you know, with his dad and that tragic situation where, for those who might have missed it, been under a rock, Steve Kerr's dad was killed while he was working in Beirut at an American university there. But I did like the way that they dovetailed that story with his big shot in the finals. But you know, I think the earlier episodes definitely for me just spoke more to me. I loved the Pippen episode, the Rodman episode, the one about the marketing of MJ. So you know, those kind of were my high water marks. This was kind of coming back down to reality. I don't know, how'd you see it?
So I have a few things that I felt were critiqued about. Number one, how are we just now finding out that it was food poisoning in the flu game? You know, that it wasn't the flu. He had food poisoning in that. How does that story never get out? Also, well, if you're already suspicious about the pizza going into it, why still give him the pizza? And then why continue to eat the entire pizza?
All right, so I'll handle all three. First off, it was always known as the flu game, even though food poisoning was something that had been discussed at various points. Obviously, not perhaps to the detail level of detail. The pizza, why on earth? Michael Jordan would like to have a pizza delivered to his room.
Exactly. Why is some random personnel guy who's just operating under a normal name not ordering that pizza? Like, Michael Jordan's not ordering a pizza himself at that time of night, right?
One would think. I mean, never been to Salt Lake, so I'm not going to try to espouse on Salt Lake pizza. But, it's one of those, wish it, woulda, shoulda, coulda, taken the pizza away from him, or, just travel with a jar of PB&J or something.
Yeah, like there has to be a team nutritionist there that just has something that they could give him. But, the fact that he even ate the entire pizza, like, you got to share a slice of that with, your trainer, some guys that might just be around, whatever. So that was the number one thing that kind of surprised me about episode 9, was that just that whole revelation that it was food poisoning and not necessarily a flu game. And number two, last week we mentioned some aspects of the episodes that were missing, right? Like his family members, his wife, his kids. We did get a glimpse of them in episode 9, specifically kind of just talking about the environment that was Utah in that series. That almost felt forced. It didn't feel organic like the rest of the series had felt, almost. Like, it was like, oh no, we have these interviews with them. How do we fit them in, and how do we make them relevant to this timeline? And, it kept going back to the idea that in the back of my mind is Michael is a very private person, and maybe he just didn't want his kids being subjected to this story. But at the same time, they're a necessity. They're an important part of this story.
Yeah, there are certain things about the family story that let's just say they're available online for those who want to take all that stuff in. They were trying to tell the story of Michael Jordan and the Bulls and the dynasty. Jordan, the family man. To what degree that, I don't know, fit into the overall narrative? I mean, I was definitely expecting to see more family than we saw. And definitely not expecting to see it in the way that it was presented. But having said that, I kind of understood after seeing everything and knowing, seeing what I've seen after the fact, I kind of understand why they went the way they did.
Yeah, and I completely get your point. It just seems that, like, if you're going to put them in, especially in that spot and that late in the documentary, that it would have been more than essentially one scene with the two of them. Like, they would have come back up either at the end of episode 10 as we're kind of getting to know Michael post that dynasty, or just some relevance of maybe him going to one of their games, whether, they were in college or whatnot. So that just seemed like a very forced scene. And it was the first time really in this whole series that I felt like it wasn't a cohesive documentary. And there's been a lot of people that have either gone on Twitter, that have gone on Facebook, have said, by and far, this is the best documentary I have ever seen. That the way that it's put together, the way that the narrative is still told is just tremendous. And I don't know if maybe I'm the only one who felt like this, but I just didn't get that throughout. Yeah, it was emotional and it was fun to relive some of those big moments of the 90s. And, for someone that when this dynasty was happening and taking place, I was not necessarily into the NBA. I was a kid from Kansas that grew up in Kansas City that followed college basketball very heavily because we didn't have an NBA team. But everyone knew who Michael Jordan and the Bulls was. So to relive this and to experience this, and a lot of these images for the first time, like a lot of people, that was fun. But from a narrative perspective and from a documentary perspective, I just didn't understand the full hype that centered around this and the love for it. Did you?
I definitely got the hype. I definitely thought and saw why people would love it and go crazy for it. And maybe I'm partially misunderstanding, the premise here. But as a guy who grew up in New York and was kind of the folks, the Knicks fans who always seemed to take it on the chin. There was one trivia question, and I'm sitting there with my wife. Which Hall of Famer was ousted most? And I didn't even look up. I just, Patrick Ewing, and sure enough, Patrick. She's like, she turns to me. She goes, "How did I?" I honey, I live this like every May. It was like one of those things you dread. You know, it's kind of like the first huge snowfall in January. Well, come May, it's like, how are we going to bite it this year?
And I was MJ going to hurt you this time. But no, exactly. So like that perspective of it is fun. It's just reliving his dominance was great, and being this larger than life character that he really was, and just being this ultimate alpha male was tremendous and a lot of fun to watch. But from just like a pure storytelling narrative and a pure documentary perspective, I don't know if it was maybe just the idea that everybody has been locked up and it was the only thing that we could gravitate to at that time. But I thought the way that it was put together had a lot of flaws in it, had a lot of holes in it. And so that's just my take. And it might not be a common one. It might not be something that everybody loves, but it was just something from my perspective. You know, the kind of going back and forth on the timelines in episodes was sometimes very jumbled and felt very confusing. I thought
the timeline was clean to me. It gave you that kind of natural break, and you know, with the visuals and the kind of little ticker moving back and forth. What did you think about, because this, I have a definite thought on this. I want to get your take on it before I mouth off. But the end, the Pearl Jam finale. What are your thoughts on that? First off, you're a man of a certain age, so I don't know if Pearl Jam necessarily means the same thing to you.
So here's the thing. You know, you and our producer both said the Pearl Jam rollout. I don't know a Pearl Jam song.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Everybody. Yeah. All right.
This is the thing. And I'm fine with admitting this right now. You know, I saw the montage at the end, but I don't know Pearl Jam.
Oh my gosh.
And right. I'm not right. ashamed to admit that.
All right. So
for you to know my musical library is just a bunch of like indie rock bands that nobody's ever heard of and that nobody will ever care about, but they're special to me. So
I think in my head I'm literally on one knee right now. But you should be.
It's very embarrassing for me, myself, and I, but it's
anyway. Another song you kind of triggered in my head. All right, so I'll say this. I love Pearl Jam. Now, I don't follow them around the country like some of, you know, friends and people I've known through the years. Our producer, Scott Turkin, I know is a big fan, loves them. I'm a big fan, love them. I think Scott probably loves them more than me. But here's the thing. I didn't like the ending. I didn't feel like the music went with the pictures for me personally. I thought it's felt like a little out of character for the era. I realized that the music was out at that time, and so date wise that kind of matches up. But when I think of Chicago Bulls,
it felt like it should have been more hip hop, didn't it? With the way the other musical elements of the stories were told with. And personally, the opening scroll for every episode just pulled on my heartstrings every single time. I don't know why, but it did. Mm-hmm. And so I get that, you know, people don't like to admit it, but music is a big part of every storytelling aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely kind of centers you. It's funny sometimes if you watch a scary movie and you put on some like classical music, it's like all of a sudden it's like not really scary.
You're like, what's going on with this? What did you think? What do you think this series did for the conversation MJ opposite of LeBron? Did it reaffirm your belief? And, you know, maybe that's not the right way to phrase it, but did it cement to you that MJ was the superior player between the two? Or are they just completely different conversations?
I mean, definitely the alpha male. I mean, this is no question. I think if anything, it probably, you can draw an even sharper distinction between the two guys. It would be hard for me to visualize, and I'm not saying this doesn't happen, but it'd be hard for me to visualize the competition, you know, 24/7 competition on the golf course, you know, throwing dice the way that MJ, you know, was doing that. I'm not to say that LeBron is not competitive. I don't want to go down that road.
but what you're alluding to is that the competitive spirit of MJ lived in everything. It wasn't just basketball. And MJ's ultimate appeal to essentially be just a guy, right? Like, despite being a larger than life figure, his ultimate goal was whatever sport it was, whoever was playing it, whoever he was on the field, the golf course, the room with, he just wanted to be the best at that. So, and that's where I think it's fair to draw a distinct line between the two. You know, LeBron is a great basketball player in so many different ways. You know, the way he moves, the way he passes, the way he sees the game develop, probably quicker than a lot of his peers have, you know, and just his physical dominance is so much different than the way MJ moved. But the drive and the goal to be better than every single person at every single game is very different than I think how LeBron wants to and chooses to live his life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other big distinction here, it would be the notion that guys wanted to play with, you know, whether they did or did not want to play with Jordan versus do they or do not they, you know, want to play with LeBron. And the takeaway that I would have is, I mean, yes, everyone wants to play with Jordan because they want to get a ring, but it seemed like it was always a pained decision that people had to make to decide whether they want to endure that. You don't really hear people talking about enduring that when playing with LeBron. I mean, there's certainly, you know, expectations got to, you know, live up to, you know, making sure you're playing your A game when you're with him. But I don't know if you picked up on that or have, you know.
No, absolutely. And that's part of what I was asking, you know, when we had BJ on the show last week. There's an idea that whenever you play with a player like this, whether it's Michael Jordan, whether it's LeBron James, that when you're a teammate of someone like that, you are essentially helping to protect their legacy. You know, when LeBron was making all those finals runs, whether it was with the Heat, Cavs, and hopefully at some point with the Lakers, you know, the people that he assembles around him understand that the goal is much bigger than, you know, to make it to the finals, but, and to win a championship. The goal is to also help protect the legacy that is LeBron James, because he is the face of the NBA right now. And it was clear that a lot of Bulls players felt burdened with that idea. And so that's a very tough thing for them to swallow and for them to, I guess, grapple with.
Agree on all that.
but I will say this, and this is just to close the Jordan and LeBron argument. The people who, and you'll see this, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's on ESPN, they'll put a graphic out there that has their scoring numbers side by side, right? Whether it's in the finals, regular season, mm-hmm. postseason. People need to understand that those are not fair comparisons. And the reason they're not fair comparisons is because of how drastically different the games are. And, you know, you saw it in those final two episodes, 9 and 10, where the scores are 87 to 85, and every possession seems like it matters each and every time. But also, the sheer number of possessions that occur in each NBA game today. You know, you mm-hmm. didn't have that in the 90s. Like, what is it? Most teams average, like, what is it, 120 possessions per game or something like that in today's NBA. There was no way that was happening in the 90s.
No. All good points. All good points. We've just witnessed Last Dance. Bulls put him to bed. Now, is there another franchise, another story out there that you would want to see or hear or relive? Or live for the first time, depending on which one you're going to go with.
So if we're keeping this to basketball specific and NBA specific, the one that really kind of piques my interest and is the story of the Seattle Supersonics and how that city was basically had a team stolen from them and their team was whisked away kind of and had the rug pulled out from under them. Just to relive those images in Key Arena, and there's been tremendous podcasts and docu-storytellings done through them, but there's never been a true in-depth series on all the steps that it took to get that team out of that city. That would be a lot of fun. Personally, for me, this is something everyone rolls their eyes when they hear it, is the Kansas Jayhawks won 15 straight Big 12 championships, Otto. Think about that. 15 years in college basketball with the one and done rule, with how often players move schools, and to win a Power 5 conference championship for 15 straight years. When that documentary series is done about how those teams had to be constructed, how you have to account for players leaving for the league, how you have to account for players that are coming in. That's going to be incredibly interesting. And the only other one I'll say this is how the one and done rule not only affected the NCAA, but also the NBA when it was put in place. What say you?
All right. So I would love to kind of get the real story on Chris Paul and the Lakers and what, you know, what would have happened had he gone to LA. This would have been back in 2011.
Before the trade was vetoed.
Exactly. Back in 2011. And you look and see like who the Lakers would have gotten, who the Hornets would, you know, the New Orleans Hornets then would have gotten. I mean, obviously the trajectory of the entire NBA would have been completely different. So looking at those guys, that'd be something that would have been a lot of fun. You know, another one that you know, for me personally would have been special is kind of looking at, and I know these guys never made it to the mountaintop, so it's like, who cares? But some of those Knicks squads were, I mean, I don't know if they were really a 10-part. I guess if you don't win a title, you're not really a 10-part. Maybe you're a 3-part, but you know, whatever. But some of those Knicks teams were just the personalities that they had, and the kind of defensive oriented style that they had. It's just, you know, something that you could really, a lot of the lunch pail guys in New York really loved.
What about Kobe's Lakers and that dynamic with Phil Jackson and kind of his second run with the dynasty?
All right. So you're not talking about the Shaq Kobe, but you're talking about the second, you know,
you can talk about the Kobe Shaq ones, but also just from Phil Jackson's perspective, you know, kind of stewarding two different dynasties. Mm-hmm. Not very many people get that opportunity. And then I guess you can also, on the flip side, say it from a player who was part of a dynasty and Steve Kerr, and then to trying to massage and manage his own dynasty with those Warriors teams.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's certainly no shortage of content there from, you know, Draymond's colorful ways to
who gets to be the villain in that series? It's definitely Kevin Durant, right? If you're doing one on like, so the whole idea was that Jerry Krause was the ultimate villain in this Bulls dynasty, right? He was the reason they broke up, that it never worked out. Kevin Durant has to be the villain in why this Warriors team is no longer constructed.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect he is. I mean, it's just like, I mean, things do not last forever. I don't know what do people think he was going to just stay there for, you know, retire as a Warrior? I guess I never really bought into the fact that he was kind of a tried and true member of the Warriors, like Curry, like Thompson, like Draymond. So his leaving didn't really bother me. I mean, like,
it's not so much the leaving, it's the aspect of how he responded that final year in Golden State. You know, there's books and there's articles written about just how sour of a teammate he was, not only, you know, kind of envious of the relationship that Steph had with Warriors fans, but also the way that he kind of was combative with Draymond that final year. And so, and you know, you can go for days and just kind of the rabbit hole of social DMs that he was sending potentially from burner accounts too. So that's just who I think would be the villain in that series.
Well, now there's another team that we have not talked about, another player we haven't talked about, which is kind of odd since he's taken two teams to titles and kind of on the verge of perhaps a third, and that would be LeBron.
Yeah, those that whole story of LeBron's rise with the Cavs and then the decision and his move to Miami, just the way that team came together and the moving parts and how they had to essentially plan that out between the three of them, that would be a phenomenal story to hear, and just all the different moving parts and, you know, also kind of the rise of Eric Spoelstra as a head coach, right? Someone that when he essentially took the reins of that team, people probably didn't envision him becoming the coach that he is today. Is that fair to say? And then with Pat Riley at the helm of that organization?
Well, you know, he worked under Riley. And so, you know, Riley's going to, you know, reward his guy. So I'm not surprised. I mean, he definitely put in the hours. I mean, I remember stories about him, you know, being in the film room, basically seemingly damn near living there. So I think he was getting his mail there in the film
Is the opening scroll of the Heatles docuseries not one, not two, not three?
It has to be.
Being two. It ends up being two.
Yeah. I mean, you know, kind of a fluke series with the Mavs to some degree, and look, I mean, they could have easily wound up with one. You know, the series in which they beat the Spurs was, you know, that's I didn't have to go that way. So
yeah, and you know, that also solidifies just how good those Bulls teams were. You know, those Bulls teams were built with an idea in mind of where that team was going. And let's close the show on this because I thought there was a very good point that one of our producers, Bruce Bernstein, pointed out was the love that they essentially gave to Jerry Krause at the very end of episode 10, where, you know, they're talking about you do have to give him love for the roster construction. And it was the first time that they had said anything positive about Jerry Krause, and it just felt so fleeting at the end.
Was it they or was it Scotty? Because I remember Scotty.
Well, Scotty said it. Scotty was the one who said it.
Yeah. I'm not sure, so sure how effusive others were, but
it definitely wasn't MJ who said it. It was Scotty.
Exactly.
But you know, it just felt like such a nice change of pace from building this villain for 9 episodes and then giving him some due at the end.
Yeah. I mean, look, any story, you know, you need an arc to any story. And so, you know, this was his. And, you know, nice to see that, you know, Pippen could recognize the fact that, the guy did put a good team together.
Yeah, like finding supportive players and drafting players is not an easy thing to do. How many GMs lose their job today because they see someone who is a top 5 talent and they don't pan out?
Hey, exactly. So real quick, I know we're going to wrap up, but would they have done a four-peat?
No.
If they'd come back?
No. Yeah, you look at it, especially if you're looking at it in terms of roster construction, there's no way they could have fit it under the cap.
Yeah.
And Jordan's comments at the end that Pippen would have come back on a one-year deal. Okay, Pippen comes back on a one-year deal. What's that number? And then how do you fill out a roster around him, a healthy roster around him that's also young? Because a team that picks at the end of the draft every year is not a young team, and it's not a good team.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that would have been interesting, and there's no way that, you know, who knows how it would have worked out, but the fact that there was the lockout and the season was shortened to 50 games, you know, it's one of those, you know, fans can debate it. People like us can chew on it for months and years and decades, but we don't have all that time. We have to wrap. And so with that, this has been Catch and Shoot 2.0. Thanks to our producers, Scott Sturken and Bruce Bernstein, as well as our editor, Ben Wolfen.
And as always, we like to promote our own here on Pure Hoops Media. Mondays, it is the Mike Weiss Show. This week, Mike was joined by Sam Smith. If you've been watching the documentary, you know who Sam Smith is, longtime Chicago-based writer. Tuesday is Full Court Press with Fanta and Adams. Wednesday, it is Catch and Shoot right here with our boy Otto and myself. Thursdays, this show is going to be a lot of fun. Monica McNutt on Buckets, Boards, and Blocks is having Andrea Kramer on. She was the ESPN Chicago correspondent during the 90s. That should be a really fun listen. And it all wraps up on Friday with a Pure Hoops podcast with Eric Newman and BJ Armstrong. Hey guys, if you like the shows, if you enjoy them, all that we ask is that you rate and subscribe. And if you have a friend, share it with them as well. But until next week, we'll see you guys next week.
Hey, and one final word here, folks. Yes, you know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say it anyway. As we continue to practice our safe social distancing and washing our hands and all that good stuff, we want to remind everybody that the first responders, those folks who are bringing us our meals, who are attending to our healthcare needs, who are putting out fires, literally and figuratively, police officers, we want to make sure that everyone is maintaining the proper level of decorum and respect for all parties involved. We know that this is a difficult time as we transition back into the regular flow of things around the country, but we just, again, want to make sure that everyone is just showing that extra level of decorum that we know you guys are more than capable of doing. So thanks, everybody. We're all in this together. Be strong.
Catch and Shoot 2.0 is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.